Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis. And today, we're having the second conversation with Clay Boykin, the founder of the Men's Fellowship Network Circle of Men Project. Hello, Clay.
Hey, Dennis. How you doing?
Oh, fine. I was watching on television the other day, and I'm very interested in our histories of when we came of age. This drug, testosterone, that hits us in our early adolescence, and what it does to our brains, and what it does to brains of men around the world. You came into your adolescence what year?
Oh gosh, it was in general, it was late 60s.
The late 60s. Okay, I came into my adolescence in the early 60s. So actually, 1960 would probably be 1959, 1960. Were you aware of when you were in your early childhood as a young boy, did sex come across your brain even pre-adolescence? Because I was very, very interested from childhood. I picked up on that the adults were this was something forbidden. They were all laughed about it, they joked about it. It was on there, and so I was going, what is that?
Yeah, I didn't hear it necessarily from the adults, but, you know, gosh, I can remember back in way back first or second grade, there being some grumblings about this. And, again, the forbidden topic. And, of course, that just, made us so curious. I think it goes back that far.
Were you curious? Did you guys play doctor in your neighborhood? I mean, it's so weird to say this in 2020 because if I would think of us playing doctor that suddenly, I can see the police coming to haul off this 6-year-old pervert because he's playing doctor with a local girl.
I don't remember that, but I do remember that I had a girlfriend in first grade. Mm-hmm. I remember her name. That was Rita. I won't share the last name, but that was in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And then in second grade, I was in Davis, California, and I had a girlfriend, and her name was Laura. And of all things, she was deaf. And we were the best of friends. And I don't remember ever during those times there being any curiosity about sex. I think it was we were buddies. We were friends.
Yeah.
But in the back of my mind, like I said earlier, there was this question.
Sure.
It never really came up in our relationship.
I wonder about that because, I was When I think of, I was always attracted to little girls.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, when I hear some people say, well, your sexuality, your gender preference is a choice. And I want to say to them, well, perhaps it is for you, but for me, I remember wanting to be around little girls, being attracted to, being falling in love with my teachers, doing that were women. It was like wired in. It wasn't something that I chose.
Right.
And so I can understand it when my gay friends and my lesbian friends tell me the same thing, that it was wired into them, even though I'm not taking away from those people who say it's a choice, that they may be right in the middle and go, okay, well, I'm going to choose for them. It just wasn't that way for me.
Right. And even early experiences that weren't by choice, impacted people's the rest of my life. And and again, there too, I wasn't in that situation by choice. So you're right. I mean, for me, I came into the world as I am with my questions and my orientation feeling. I didn't choose to be that way. And then, you know, I was abused when I was young. And that wasn't a choice either. And that had a lasting effect on me.
How old were you?
I was fourth, fifth grade. There was a range of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of hard to talk about.
Thank you for sharing that with me. I will share with you that my babysitter in the first grade, a girl babysitter, she was about 15, had sexual games with me when I was in the first grade. And that was part of my getting very interested in sex. I'm not blaming that on that, but it was part of my experience. And then as I would go, in the different towns, we were in Chicago and then we were in Pittsburgh, but I remember going down, we would go shopping or do something. And a couple of men pulled me behind the counter at different times and felt me up. And it was a lot more. But these were, there was just it happened to me too often. And then, of course, I've been in a number of rooms where people choose to be anonymous over these last 25 years. And Clay, I swear to God, there is such a broad range of ethnicities and gender and economic circumstances, but the themes of the number of people that went through molestation I think it's way undercounted.
Oh gosh, yeah. I'd be surprised if, I'd be speaking out of school, but it seems like hardly anybody gets through childhood unscathed in some way, you know. And I mean, mine went up through junior high. And,
exactly.
After that, no. But older preying on the younger was. Yeah. Looking back on it, and I was naive enough to think that I was the only one that this was happening to, and it was my fault. And so I had to bury that. So now I've got a secret, and that secret I couldn't share with my parents. So it put a wall between us. And, that wall never, ever really totally came down.
Yep. And it shaped both of us.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of experiences, and I'm so glad that you brought up the secrecy aspect of it, because that secrecy, the toxicity of secrecy, goes directly into shame.
Right.
And it fuels, and it just fuels the shame. And then once I get shame, once I have that shame base, then I'm going to react to so many situations in that way. I mean, I don't know. I haven't done a lot of study in the kind of sexual dysfunction or the kinds of sexual within the Me Too movement, like Harvey Weinstein or Matt Lauer or any of the others that are getting up to the, but I have to believe for me that shame plays a big part of it, because when I don't get to share things, it become not only would it become toxic, but they actually become more attractive to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's unresolved and at least on a mind level, in years I've gone past and replayed things and trying to find resolution. and not having anyone I could turn to. Oh, there were people I could turn to, but nobody I felt like I could.
So how do you see this in 2020? Like in the circle of men that we have, that you and I both participating in this, do the men get a chance to talk about some of this shame and deal with this? Is this a subject for healing, or do we do this with our therapists? How do we in 2020 and beyond heal in this?
I would have to say that within our circle, we talk about shame to a certain point. We typically don't go into the detail. And it's kind of an unspoken thing that mm-hmm. we don't go down into the dirt too much, because it could too easily begin to sound or look like we're trying to have a therapy session, and that's not what we're there for. You know, we're there to learn how to express with another man and just being able to say, yeah, I carry shame too. That's a big statement to make to another man when you don't trust other men. So it doesn't take going deeper than that to have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And just to recognize that you got shame too. I got shame too. Yeah. Well, in general, it had to do with this or that.
Yeah.
And recognizing, oh, I'm not alone. And other people have carried this. And that's a touch up point. We may go offline and fellas have a deep conversation. And
sure.
I think countless times that's happened. And that's healthy. So that's part of the healing process. But just being able to hit it at even a high level. Oh,
yep.
Dennis, you're carrying shame too? I never saw that in you. My goodness. I carry
wonderful.
It also.
You know, I love the way you say that, Clay, because the key to me is, because I did, as I grew up, feel like, as a young man, as I looked out as what the models of what men were supposed to be, my great uncle,
mm-hmm.
who was like my grandfather, he would point at a guy and go, that's mighty much a man, was his
mm-hmm.
phrase. That's mighty much a man. And I looked inside of me and I went, I am nothing like that. Taciturn and quiet and able to bear pain and get out there and work and sweat and be all the, you know, and
mm-hmm.
just wasn't me. And emotionally closed off and just, no, but that wasn't who I was. And so I, there must be something wrong with me. And then when I see,
mm-hmm.
when I have experienced there at the circle of men, there is such a broad, there's so many different personalities, there's so many different people, and they all share. And as they share at these deep levels, I do feel like I am not alone. And that it was that aloneness, that one feeling that when I was growing up, that I was the one broken person, the one person who did not get the manual, did not get it. So it must be, there must be something wrong with me.
You know, you hit on a good point. The diversity in that circle, you know, that's the texture. That's the richness and the texture. And I've mentioned this before, but, you know, we have 20 guys in the circle, and you add everybody's age up. Right in that circle that night, we'll have over 1,000 life years of experience sitting right there. Now, think about that.
Yeah.
There's one thing, I may say one thing, and another guy picks up on it, and he goes, oh, he may not have to say anything. Or another fellow looks at me when I say something, and he's got that knowing look of me too,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it may be conscious
or
it may be subconscious. And just the energy in the room expressing in itself is healing. I'm not alone.
Isn't that the truth? So healing. But that's what we're getting a chance. We're getting a chance to participate in this in this process, because one of the thing that you're doing is that we've discussed that I so honor is, what is this archetype for the new compassionate male? Because I've been feeling that the patriarchy that I have been participating in and be part of, the white male patriarchy as it works as a older white male and that I have of course taken advantage of, but as I can see it, is that the patriarchy is actually toxic. I can see how it's toxic for women. I can see how it's toxic for minorities. But I didn't until this week really see how the patriarchy is actually toxic for men.
Absolutely.
That just this concept, this top down, I know best, and everybody else underneath me knows less until somebody knocks me off the hill to take over knowing the best of that time. That structure is not a structure in this complex world that will succeed.
Well, it's gotten us to where we are, both good and bad. And it can, both sides can be argued. I argue that there's something better, that the patriarchy wounded both men and women. We've talked about this before. I'm a privileged white male. I've got everything going for me. Yeah, well, let me tell you about my wounds, the things that you and I were just talking about that have impacted me, and the fact that I didn't feel like I could talk to someone, and the patriarchal system, it starts to impact us. Boys wear blue.
Mm-hmm.
It goes on from there. And, we've progressed. You talked about the archetypes, Robert Moore and Douglas Gillette, with King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, defining those archetypes for men to give them a frame of reference from which to understand themselves has taken men a long way forward. What I'm witnessing, and over the past year that I've, been across the U.S. and spent time there in Kenya, everyone, without exception, got this burn inside that they're pushing down. And as soon as they're able to begin to feel and into that with compassion for themselves, they open up and they begin to integrate that to become a complete male. Become the new compassionate male and show up in that passion. And what I'm saying, I believe that the new compassionate male is the yes and, is the overarching archetype to the king, warrior, magician, lover. It's its next place. And the world is begging for this. And every burn that goes on within every man, that's the burn of what's right and what they know is right down deep inside, but it's shoved down. And it's the truth, the essence of that, and that comes out. It's the golden rule. It's how we treat one another.
Yeah.
That's what the new compassionate male is all about.
God, that's and it's a very and have you – I don't mean have you. I know better than that. I know that this is happening. But tell me how you are watching yourself change over this journey. Because that's one of the things that I love about this, is that this is not a leader top-down movement. Oh, well, Clay Boykin, you've gotten there, and so therefore you go and show us all how we can get there too. And
no. No, absolutely not. I'm searching, and I'm searching, and I'm sharing. I'm not learning and teaching. Those are different things. So what I'm sharing is more raw, and it's like, this is what I'm seeing. What are you seeing? Oh, you're seeing, okay. And going across the cultures, you've got a culture of men in Atlanta. You've got the culture of men in Kansas and Texas and Kenya. They're all different subcultures. They're all, but this common theme lines through every one of them. And, you know, I'm calling it the new compassionate male. That may not be it, but I tell you what, it's ringing true over and over and over again.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead. You say it is forming.
It's forming. Yeah. I
was cheerleading on the sideline. I was high-fiving. So just continue. Don't stop.
I know. I get quite passionate about it because it's right now it's so clear to me. And then I go down deep and I say, okay, I'm just one person. How can I make a difference?
Yeah.
It's just me. How, you know, and I know I've gone into that mode. I see my guys go into that mode, you know, and we catch ourselves and we have to remind ourselves about the story of the little boy on the beach. All these starfish are on the beach, you know, and he's going down and picking one up. There were thousands of them, picking one up and tossing it back in the water, picking the next one up, tossing it in the water. And the old man comes up to him and says, you can't make a difference here. The little boy bends over, picks up another one, and he says, phew, I made a difference to that one. And I have to come back and remind myself because it's so overwhelming. You know, when I really feel and see where we are in the turn that can be made, it's not that radical. It's counterintuitive.
No.
But there's not a man out there who at some level
doesn't
have that feeling.
Exactly. And let me play optimist here. From my, as you know, I'm a blooming optimist and I have that, but my sense is this, that there is a vibration and that we're all at this, you know, if we go down to the bottom, really to the bottom of where the universe is, if E equals MC squared and with mass and energy being interchangeable and energy being vibrations, that we're actually creating this whole reality from energy, from that vibrational place. If that's true, and what the quantum scientists and the physicists tell us that it is, but and assuming that that's true, then if there's a vibrational level that we can raise, assuming that it was a lower vibration, that we could raise this vibration, that each one of the engagements that we get into, each time that we share, openly, that this vibration actually raises, because I know I've felt that. I felt a raising vibration just in that group, just in the circle of men. I mean, when I'm in a store and I reach someone and I talk and I see them eye to eye and I look into them at who, you know, hello human being, that is raising the damn vibration. And
you
don't know when that turning point's going to be, when that tipping point is going to be. But by God, I want to be part of raising that however tiny little frequency there can possibly be.
You know, just this morning I was listening to the audio book, and it's kind of both the book itself and then some commentary along with it. It's out on YouTube. Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. And they were just talking about that, about the vibration, you know, about the two tuning forks that are in the same key or pitch. You know, you knock one and it starts vibrating, and the one across the room starts vibrating. It was the exact example just a couple hours ago. I was listening to it. Good old Napoleon Hill. When did that book come out?
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
And there is nothing new under the sun. It is a reiteration.
No, sir.
It is a reiteration. It's a reaffirmation. It's a reformation of what is truth.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's interesting. I mean, the language is different, but the essence of the message is the same. You know,
Thank
Joe
you.
Dispenza talks about this, and Viktor Frankl talks about it. You know, Man's Search for Meaning.
My
Barry
hero.
Comes through the prisoner of war camp, the Holocaust, all of that, survives that. And he's speaking about this. And then you take Joe Dispenza, you know, and he's talking about a totally different language that they're speaking.
Yep.
But they're saying the same thing. And that's
the one.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. Yeah.
One will resonate with me. One will not resonate with me. And then one that does not resonate with me will resonate with me later. Ram Dass just transitioned from here.
Yes.
And it, over the past month, I have been listening in the evenings as I've been trying to deal with this insomnia that is my own. I have forgotten how to go to sleep. It's so weird. It's so weird to be so self-conscious that you forget how to go to sleep. So I've been going through this process, and I've been listening. In the evenings, I will listen to some Ram Dass. And he's talking about, in theory, about his own death and what he's going on. During this time, he died. And the process of conscious dying, and as I see this, part of what we're doing is that we're dying to our old way of being.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening in the new compassionate male. There's an emergence. We're actually being transformed.
Yeah.
And reborn into something. I mean, there's of course, in every religion, there's these metaphors and the words. But this is what's happening here.
Mm-hmm. Well, get this. I just looked it up. Think and Grow Rich was written in 1937.
Wonderful!
And go figure, right?
That's it. That's what we're doing. We're getting a chance to do it because I think about what does rich mean? Because I know what wealth is, and we're going to talk about this in another time. What is the acquisitive place, and how do we do that? And also, how do we in this process? Because I'm very interested in how you are going to be taking this movement around the world and how the movement is going to support you as you do so.
Yeah.
Because it would be one thing if you had a personal endowment of $100 million and you were able to then go out there and do
mm-hmm.
that. That's not the case.
No, you have a living to make.
Exactly. Yep. You have a leap of faith. I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah. That's October of 2018. You know, I left the business world early because I felt so passionate about this. I've been tracking it for
mm-hmm.
6 or 7 years through our men's circle. And it just said, it's, you know, if not now, when? This is my calling and stepping into that truth. And this whole year has been a great unfolding. It hasn't been so financially, but that's, you know, I'm keeping my eye on what's important. You know, I chased the dollar for so many years and, it, you know, ended up having a bypass, you know, quintuple bypass, you know, when I was 53.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, hello. Something not congruent in what's in my heart and what I'm out there doing. And
absolutely,
but having that alignment, you know, if I look back at this last year, one of the biggest things that I take out of this last year is that providence is not a metaphor; it's real.
No, and so
carrying that message, carrying the message of the new compassionate male, that's what my calling, and you know, I'm grateful for whatever support I can get along the way, and I have faith that it'll be there.
Absolutely. And this is the thing about the support, Clay, is that I believe it's coming. I believe that it's here, that the support is necessary for this, just like you have seen Brené Brown, to whom I compare you, because what she has done for both shame and the work that you're doing is as powerful as what you're doing here. All right, we're going to put a pin in it right here, Clay Boykin. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you again for another conversation. And the only thing I ask you is that, for goodness sakes, please, 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 let's do this again.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dennis.
All right. Big hugs to you. And this is Dennis Cardon, and we will see you next time.